Welcome to Tube Talk, the show dedicated to helping you become a better video creator so you can get more views, subscribers, and build your audience. Brought to you by vidIQ. Download for free at vidIQ.com.
Oh, yeah! Welcome back to another episode of Tube Talk presented by vidIQ. I am your host, Viper, the man about tech, executive producer of social media here at the IQ. And you know, this week I had to go out and do something that I don't think I've done since I started hosting a podcast, maybe once or twice, but I'm not sure. But I went out and I got both Rob and Dan to join me today, and we're going to talk about the state of YouTube in 2024. But before we get into that, Rob, Dan, hello, you guys. How are you doing?
Hey, Viper. Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be back on Tube Talk. Dan, can you remember when we steered the good ship Tube Talk for, what, 6 to 12 months? Back in, what, lockdown days, I seem to remember? Yeah. What do we talk about every single week? I'm trying to remember now.
I think YouTube a little bit.
Occasionally, but it was mostly sound effects and doing shout-outs on Twitter and stuff.
Yeah. Mostly stuff like this.
Yeah. Yeah, also wrestling noises. No, none of my sound effects are working. Good.
Oh, all right.
Awesome. Brilliant.
So it's working just as well as it always has.
Yep.
Well, I appreciate both of you gents making the time today, so thank you for being here. So a few weeks ago, YouTube CEO Neil Mohan came out with his four big bets that YouTube is making here in 2024. So I figure we can go through and talk about those and talk about some things that have happened along the way till today. And we'll see what happens. But bet number one he made was that AI will empower human creativity. Now, there's been a lot of talk and a lot of happenings around AI, especially as it relates to the creator space. YouTube themselves have even come out lately with rules that they are going to implement to govern the use of AI and how creators have to disclose whether or not they're using AI. We have AI tools out there like our very own things here at vidIQ. We have ChatGPT, MidJourney. This new thing that just came out last week or the week before, Sora now, where you can make whole AI videos. AI is everywhere. So curious to get you guys some thoughts on AI and what it will do for creators, and maybe if there's some danger points around how we use AI as content creators moving forward.
I think the key word there is empower, but not necessarily the key word creators, because it empowers all sorts of people to do all sorts of things on YouTube. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, AI should be considered just another tool in the creator's arsenal. And those who embrace it and recognize how to infuse it into their own original content will be the biggest benefactors. But also, YouTube's got an enormous job on their hands dealing with the new wave of bad actors and God knows what else is coming onto YouTube. I mean, Dan and I have probably seen this on the channel audit, certainly in the last 6 months. The number of AI channels now that we're auditing every week is increasing almost exponentially. And we see like maybe 25 to 30, 40% of them are doing a good job with AI, but others are just trying to jump on the wagon and think that because I use AI and I can do stuff very, very quickly, that automatically means channel win, but that isn't the case in reality.
And during those live streams too, when we're looking at channels that are very obviously using a lot of AI to make their content, I can't help but glance over at our live chat and there's a lot of negativity around that. And I think it's coming from a place of people feeling a bit threatened by it. And other creators are saying we should feel threatened by it. I personally don't see it that way. As Rob said, it's more of like a tool to help me create. But these channels we look at that are using like 100% AI to write their content, make the actual video itself, the physical thing you're seeing, it's images and video and stuff like that, the captions, everything like completely on my computers, those videos aren't getting views based on what we're seeing. I'm sure they're out there. They're doing some doing okay. But like the ones we're seeing are struggling. They're like, why do I get zero views? Well, a lot of your content is 100% AI and it's not really marketed towards anyone specific. And there's all kinds of things that a human brain still needs to be involved with. And a great example of that is like for me, just in my personal time, I'm trying to learn a little bit about like making a game, but I've always struggled to learn programming. So everyone tells me ChatGPT is this great thing and it can do all this stuff. I'm like, cool, maybe it can program something. I usually get far enough to maybe I can make a character move on the screen. But as soon as I want to implement anything else, I very quickly hit a wall. And you guys have probably seen this with writing and all kinds of stuff. It can only bring you so far in its current iteration before you're like, oh, I really think my squishy brain needs to know some of this stuff so I can pick out what it's getting wrong. Because if I was a programmer, I'd probably be able to see it's using functions and variables that don't exist, right? But I can't pick up on that because I'm not a programmer. And so I think it really is that right now. It's a creator having to go in and use it with the stuff they already know. Like, you still have to do some work right now if you want to succeed and use AI as like a tool that's effective.
I think the most important thing for all creators at this point is to not put your head in the creative sand, so to speak, and say, this AI stuff, I hate it. It's rubbish. It annoys me. I'm just going to ignore it. I'm afraid you can't do that. It is here. It's here to stay. And as many people keep saying, right now, it's the worst technology it's going to be. And you look at where we were 18 months ago with AI video and the Rock and the Will Smith eating spaghetti. And now Sora, as you mentioned, Viper, which is just like jaw-dropping. It's like, oh, wow. And I mentioned in a recent video that there are people now who have no YouTube experience and are going to surpass creators with thousands of hours of experience by learning how to prompt correctly to AI in 10 to 20 hours. And that is the revolution that we all have to contend with and be aware of. So exciting and scary at the same time. YouTube are embracing it. Like, another thing I should quickly mention is that AI isn't new. Like, I look at YouTube's algorithms or search and discovery engine as a forerunner to what we're seeing creatively. Like, the algorithm has existed in its current form for 5 to 10 years and is one of the greatest pieces of discovery engine, neural learning, whatever you want to call it, I've ever seen. And it's now just the fact that everything else is catching up with what YouTube has already been using for years at this point.
So going back to Dan's point earlier about people using AI and them not seeing the results that they expect because they're using AI, I think it was sometime last year, Casey Neistat made a video, and he made a video entirely using AI and prompted by AI. And I think he asked the AI to make him a video, and he did exactly as the AI instructed him to do, making that video. And it was probably the worst video he ever made, because to Dan's point, AI just does not have the human nuance that you need to have to tell a story coherently and properly to human beings. So creators really need to understand how to properly implement AI if they want to see the success that they are looking for, because you just can't let AI do all the work. That's not going to work.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, if you just follow exactly what it says, the game development analogy is a good one to think about, because a lot of people out there probably are like me. They don't know how to program. I challenge you to use AI for something, a skill that you don't have, and just try it anyway, because you will find hitting this wall. You know, when you're a creator though, and you're like, oh, I want it to write a script for me, and it writes you a script, you're like, I know I don't say stuff like that, or I know my audience isn't going to like that it just threw in this topic. You know, you will correct it, you know, because you can, because you have the knowledge and the skill to do that. So I love using AI alongside what I'm doing. Rob, like every week now, I keep insisting on bringing in a very stupid AI character to our live streams. And this is an example of how to use it alongside of what you're doing. Our live streams are about auditing channels, but we like to have a good laugh. So we have a character that we bring on screen. We have a few. One of them right now is the AI claw. That's the one I like the most. We used to have an animated claw that would pick a number, but I've decided to go ahead and animate it. And I can talk to it and say, okay, claw, like pick a number between 1 and 100. And I programmed it to be sassy. So it comes on and it's like, oh, this again. And it, you know, last time it was complaining because it hasn't had any mechanical like maintenance done in a while. And so we let it complain a little bit, and then it begrudgingly picks a number. And everyone's laughing and having a good time. Like, that's a lot of fun. And I this is like what I love about these tools. I could have never like imagined being able to do something like this and talk to a computer that can like respond the way I want it to, you know. And even though, again, I can't program, I know enough to like at least take something that someone else made, because it was made by Doug, that particular program, and like contort it to my needs, you know. And that's what we did there. So I'm rambling now, but that's just a really fun example of how I've been using it effectively to make content and be more creative than I think I previously was able to be.
So what we're saying, Dan, maybe is that creators need, as always, a good idea.
Yeah.
Some prompting skills. I think that's the new, how to call it? This is a new thing that people have got to grasp. But then going back to your point, Viper, I think Casey Neistat summed it up by saying that AI lacks soul. So yeah, you need to inject that soul into what you do creatively with AI as well.
Definitely. Ultimately, creators, you just have to figure out how to use it best for you, but don't completely rely on the AI to do the work for you, because that is the road to nowhere. All right, moving on to number two. The second big bet that Neil Mohan made was that creators should be recognized as next generation studios. Now, something happened recently that kind of ties into this, and it happened with Marques Brownlee, who's a friend of mine. Marques Brownlee recently took on a role at Ridge, and if you don't know who Ridge is or what they do, they are famous for making their compact RFID wallets. They're like minimum. They look like credit card holders in and of themselves, which I guess they are. But Marques became, I think, the chief creative partner at Ridge, and now he's on the board. So I think that's just a part of him scaling his business. But we've seen creators with their own production houses and different things like that. I mean, Linus Tech Tips has an entire media group now. Mr. Beast has his own group. I mean, this is where you can go as creators now when you are becoming the next version of what you want your YouTube business to be. So, Dan, I see you nodding your head. What are your thoughts on this?
I love it. I came up as somebody, when I was growing up, I thought the coolest thing would be to be on the radio. This is why I love podcasting too. Like, I always wanted to be on the radio. And so my first like real job, with air quotes around it, was at a radio station. And it was so exciting. And it was like this experience I finally got to have. The problem was, even in school, you know, everyone's saying like, well, this is a dying medium. You know, the students taking the classes that I was in to be in radio were just as hopeless as the people who worked in the building that I got to work in. And the other thing about that was that it was gatekept really, really heavily. Mm-hmm. The people running the station wouldn't let people just get on the radio, right? Even though you're in the building, everyone's all proud of me. Like, you got in the building. Congrats. I'm not going to be on the air. You know, no matter how much I did, there were gatekeepers standing in my way at every stage. And looking back, I understand why, you know, and I get it. It's not like I'm holding a grudge or anything. But what I love about YouTube and platforms like it is that there are no gatekeepers. It is just you. Like, whatever you have at your disposal, usually a cell phone, can be enough to actually start getting whatever it is you want to get out there. And that is like, you know, the coolest thing about the evolution of it, where it started out as people just on whatever little camera they could get their hands on, you know, making videos in their bedroom, to now full on studios. And Mr. Beast is like the first example we think of, because he's the biggest creator. And we've seen pictures of this massive, you know, property that he has and all these people that work for him. We get it. It's like a big production studio. But like you mentioned, Linus Tech Tips and stuff, this is like, so there's smaller versions of that all over the place. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding them more and more and more. I'm finding more channels pop up where I've never seen them before. And as I start watching and I'm getting pushed their podcast clips and stuff, I'm like, oh, they're in an office. Like, there's people walking around, but oh, they have like employees. Like, they're, I just found this person. They're already well established. And, you know, another early example would be Rooster Teeth. Like, they started out making Machinima video game videos, and they grew to be a whole operation with many, many employees. Like, there's just so many examples now. And I think the last thing I'll say about this is, like, if you're a creator thinking like, wow, what a cool opportunity, I would love to run my own studio one day, don't forget, like, just you making videos is a skill set you're building. Like, this is a something you could put on a resume and something that you could take into one of these companies. That is another way you can get an experience, is to actually work for another established channel too. Like, yep. If I was trying to get into radio and take it seriously, I would have never left that building. I would have kept, or at least I would have kept looking for other jobs in radio, right? Eventually, I realized this isn't actually for me. I don't like this as much as I thought I would, and I moved on. But I would have stayed there, and I would have kept trying to climb the ladders and ranks that I needed to eventually get on the air and have my own show. That was the goal of, like, childhood me. But now the goals are different for people. It's like, I want to have my own YouTube channel, or I want to have my own YouTube studio. So look for jobs out there. See who's hiring. And that could be very small scale, or that could be people who have full-blown offices or have remote offices or whatever it might be.
Dan, from your radio days, do you have like a favorite stinger or line that you had to say? You know, like, welcome to WKDFE, the best radio in North America.
I got to edit some of those. We had like a voiceover person, but I did do a number of like ad spots.
Yeah.
And I don't have any favorites of those. That was the closest I got. I got to do ad spots.
Oh, I would have loved to have heard your, I still think you should start your own podcast. Dan's radio voice podcast of some kind. There's still time. I mean, you are the creative director. You can make it happen here at vidIQ.
That's true.
Yeah, it is. So, I don't really know what else to add to what Dan has said other than we're definitely in that transition phase where we all remember a time where YouTube didn't exist and such opportunities to have an enormous audience just did not exist. And I very much agree with Dan's sentiment of it wasn't necessarily how skilled you were. Sometimes it was who you knew, which would open doors. Mm-hmm. And for introverts, that could be a very daunting thing. But now YouTube just gives you the audience for you, and the cost is a mobile phone and an internet connection. And it all starts from there. You know, you use Mr. Beast as the example. He started making videos in his bedroom, and we all saw that his first couple of hundred videos were terrible, but he just kept at the YouTube craft. And so, you know, even today, although it is a highly competitive, very mature platform now, I guarantee you somebody's going to start their YouTube channel today, and within a year's time, they'll have a silver play button. There may be one person starting today who has a gold play button, and, you know, YouTube Shorts makes that even more attainable,
yeah,
given the number of videos that they can put out and the views that they can receive from it.
There's a lot of negativity around shorts too. There are people we see all the time who are like, I don't like shorts, but understand that like there are people who do, and like it's at least when people say that, I'm always hoping, I hope they respect shorts though, because it's opening up even more doors and opportunities and solidifying YouTube as a digital platform that is to be taken seriously. I mean, I saw a comment on a video today on our channel. So one of the comments said, YouTube is my TV. And a lot of people probably agree with that, you know, comment. It's true. So it's just shorts is this massive opportunity as well for people who want to go down that route.
For every like 100 people who say they hate YouTube shorts, there's a Jenny Hoyos who said, well, I love them. And I've built an empire through YouTube shorts.
All right. There's a couple of things to unpack here. To Dan's point earlier about gatekeepers and different things like that, it's definitely different on the YouTube side, but in creators trying to become their own studio, there are other opportunities within that. You have actual brands out here who are hiring content creators for social media stuff or to create in-house content for that brand. So there are a bunch of different avenues that creators can take to become their own studio moving forward. And the other thing about gatekeepers is that I was having a conversation, or I think I wasn't really having it, but I know my friend Roberto Blake was having a conversation on social media the other day about YouTube and its lack of gatekeepers versus having a regular 9-to-5 job, and it's one harder than the other. And here's the rub. Yes, when you get a 9-to-5 job, there is going to be some gatekeeping because a lot of times, well, most of the time or whatever, if you get a solid 9-to-5 that requires you going to school, getting an education, getting a degree, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some gatekeeping in that. But just because there's no gatekeeping type deal going on YouTube does not mean it's easier. Because to get on YouTube and be successful, you have to build an audience, cultivate that audience. You have to, like you guys were mentioning earlier, wear all the hats. You have to negotiate with brands and different things like that. Figure out how to sell yourself, sell the products and services, and just stay relevant, I guess, for lack of better terminology. Because being a YouTuber and sustaining success on a platform is hard. Not to mention, you have to understand how the platform works. So in a lot of ways, being that next generation or becoming that next generation studio and being a successful YouTuber and a business person on YouTube is harder than having a 9-to-5 job. Even though there are no gatekeepers on the YouTube side, it requires a lot of work. And I made the analogy to Roberto. I'm like, listen, when I have a 9-to-5, when I clock out at 5, I can leave the work behind. I can't do that as a content creator. Even as a social media manager at vidIQ, there is no clocking out. I always have to think about what's coming next for vidIQ and our content, and that's the way content creators are. There's no clocking out. So in some aspects, it's a little difficult because it's hard to get away from the grind of being a content creator on a day-to-day basis. So it's something to think about as we talk about and have this conversation.
Look, as YouTube creators ourselves, we've all been there. Sometimes the next video on your weekly upload schedule is right around the corner, but you have no idea what you're going to record. Well, this exact situation is why vidIQ developed Daily Ideas. It's our newest tool that can help provide you with up to 50 new video ideas every single day. Your daily ideas are generated by our AI, which analyzes your channel and the wider YouTube community to find trending topics with high view potential. With this new tool, you'll never run out of great ideas for new videos. You can try Daily Ideas for yourself today by downloading vidIQ at vidIQ.com.
Number three, Neil Mohan, third big bet is that YouTube next frontier is the living room and subscription. And Dan, what you're talking about, how a lot of creators are talking about, or people in general are talking about how YouTube is their new TV. And I think there was just an announcement made by YouTube, or not made by YouTube, by Nielsen on social media yesterday. YouTube is the number one streaming platform by watch time over the past 12 months. So think about that. Over the last year, more people are watching YouTube than any other streaming platform. And that in and of itself just brings a lot of opportunity for content creators that want to be on YouTube. But yeah, that I mean, why wouldn't YouTube attack that? I mean, I think they were talking about like maybe having shorts be more viewable on a TV, to your point, Dan, about shorts being the thing. And you got the subscription stuff going on with YouTube Music and YouTube Premium, channel membership, their thing. So YouTube is embracing the next wave of content and how the content marketplace is going to look in the next 5 to 10 years for subscription, because I hate to bring it bare bad news, but subscriptions are not going nowhere. I think they're going to be here for a long time. But what do you got? What do you guys thoughts on this next wave with YouTube being the new TV?
I would love to know from Nielsen. Like, they said that all the watch time's coming from YouTube. Are they including YouTube TV in that calculation? Because YouTube TV is a service where you literally watch TV stations and pay an even larger subscription fee. And it's interesting that they would say that. And maybe that context is out there, I'm not sure, but that would certainly skew the numbers in my head. But I'm not surprised. Like, certainly the number one app on my smart TV is the YouTube app. And then whatever show that I'm watching, those streaming services fall second, third, and fourth to that. But YouTube is like, if nothing else is on, I'm going to find something to watch on YouTube. And that's where my TV knows automatically I'm going to go every time I turn it on.
I think YouTube on TV is a little more mature, at least in the US, because you talk about YouTube TV, Dan, and I'm not 100% familiar with this, but it's something along the lines of where you can watch television programs from other broadcast networks via YouTube in some capacity.
Yeah, rather than a cable subscription, you can get, like, I think Hulu has something like this, YouTube. Yeah. You pay them like 60, 70, 80 bucks a month, whatever it is, and you get all the TV stations, and a lot of them have like recording features too. So if you miss a show, you just go on demand. So just like a cable subscription, but YouTube happens to be the person giving that to you.
Okay, so that doesn't exist, at least in the UK, as far as I'm aware. So I think YouTube still have some work globally on this idea. But I think going back to the platform as a whole, is this one of the reasons why we feel as if there is this almost like the polarization of short form content getting shorter thanks to YouTube Shorts, but also long form content getting longer because more people are consuming on television, and we're seeing the rise of less editing but more raw authenticity from creators. I don't know if there's any numbers behind it to particularly support that, but that's certainly what seems to be influencing my viewing preferences these days. And so, yeah, it's an interesting, I don't want to use the word battleground, but creators now just seem to have so much choice and options, it can be really difficult to decide what type of creator and content they want to make. It's like, should I make 6-minute videos that appeal to this particular audience who watches on a mobile phone? Because that's kind of where we were in 2019. But now, do I also need to make an extended director's cut for the people who want to watch me on television? You know, it's almost like paralysis of creative choice sometimes when you think about it.
The device matters a lot too, because I'm way more likely to click on a 40-minute video on my TV. I am not going to settle in for 40 minutes with holding my cell phone. That's not a thing I'm going to do. So I do respect that in their announcement, they said like a lot of people are watching on televisions now, and they brought some data to back that up. And I'm like, yeah, I'm watching on television more, and I'm gravitating towards longer videos, because what am I doing when I'm sitting in front of my TV? Usually I'm trying to relax. Maybe I'm eating dinner. I don't want to keep skipping through shorts. I don't want to keep finding another 5-minute video here and a 4-minute video there. I want to watch somebody do something that would be the length of a TV show. And maybe it's like a deep dive on some topic or some video essay or something like that. And I love content like that now. I never used to watch stuff like that, but I'm finding that I'm watching less traditional television shows, and I'm gravitating towards these creators who are making really cool stuff. Maybe in just a little tiny way, the writer's strike has done this a little bit, because there's now a kind of a dearth of traditional television content, thanks to that big gap we have to fill with the writer's strike ending. So for a minute there, I ran out of stuff to watch, and I'm like, oh, I like this creator, and I like this creator, and this one's cool. So it kind of got me attached to these other creators, and now the TV shows for me are secondary. It's like, when I have time, I will watch this show. But right now, this creator's putting stuff out all the time, and I want to see all of it. So I'm going to prioritize that.
That's interesting, Dan. So is this another U.S. phenomenon? Did this strike, was it the back end of last year? Was there just a desert of stuff on TV? It was just all reruns.
It's catching up now. Like, okay. Basically, there was enough in the can to keep putting stuff out. Some TV networks, I think, staggered releases after the strike happened. But I think I'm almost feeling it a little more now than when the strike was actually going on, because they weren't working for a time, and so there was nothing being made. And it at least of the shows I like to watch, I'm finding them harder to find. There's only one or two things right now that I'm actively watching that are still being like trickled out. And usually by right now, in like, you know, early, like late winter, early spring, there would be more stuff, and there's not. And so, yeah, in the US, the Writers Guild of America like went on strike for well over 100 days. It's the longest strike, I think, in the history of their organization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, came out on the other side with a better deal. But that was always going to be the impact of this. Even if the strike was much shorter, it still would have created a gap somewhere. And I've filled that gap myself with YouTube creators.
That is a little bit of a throwback to the first big bet of AI content, because wasn't the big demands of the striking writers and I think actors that they were worried about AI taking over their jobs, like especially in voiceovers and stuff. I seem to remember that being mentioned in particular. And now it makes me wonder if creators might find themselves in this situation in like 5 to 10 years, where AI becomes so sophisticated that I can just like download a Mr. Beast video, upload it to some less than legal AI tool and say, remake this video, but I want Mr. Beast to do this challenge instead of this one.
Or put me in place of Mr. Beast.
Or put me in place of Mr. Beast. And, you know, if that happens, there isn't going to be a union that's going to be able to defend creators. So I guess this is kind of like reaching out to Neil Mohan a little bit on YouTube. Do you think YouTube and other creative platforms have a responsibility to protect creators' work, you know, just beyond the obvious copyright thing? Because I don't know if there's going to be enough of a movement, if anything like this happens, for a couple of creators to say, look, we're telling the community that this is happening, this is wrong, and we all need to stop making content right now. Like, how do you influence a million creators to follow a movement like that?
Well, Rob, that actually is a perfect segue into big bet number four. And big bet number four is protecting the creator economy is foundational. So Neil Mohan is also thinking about ways to protect creators, but not only protect creators, he wants to protect YouTube, the platform, obviously. He wants to make sure that viewers and advertisers have a pleasant experience while they're on YouTube. Now, sometimes it comes making moves that creators sometimes aren't always on board with, but ultimately it benefits all of us if advertisers are comfortable advertising on the platform, because that is how the creator economy is even a thing. It wouldn't be a thing without advertising. So we have to respect what advertisers want and need. And also we have to respect what viewers want and need as well. So Neil Mohan is definitely focused on protecting the platform for advertisers and viewers as well.
Well, the creator economy is, again, something that didn't exist 20 years ago.
Right.
And now it has like the gross domestic product of, you know, mid-sized European countries. I think this is a little bit of an old statistic now, but I'm sure I read somewhere that the US YouTube economy was something like $250 billion. I think, I mean, I'm probably going to have to do a search and check this. But also, there are now, 3 million creators in the YouTube Partner Program, which is more people who work than who work for Apple and Amazon and Walmart combined, or something ridiculous like that. As you say, and another thing is that they're not necessarily employees. These are all self-employed. Well, the majority of these people are kind of self-employed in one sense. So yeah, making sure that this thing exists in the next 20 years is really important. And I'm just going to go off and try and find that statistic and make sure I'm right, because I could have been completely wrong.
I was looking for something myself, because I'm kind of wondering, and this information is probably out there, I'm wondering what's allowed, because this is something that a lot of industries are dealing with right now. This is one of the reasons the writers went on strike. It was, hey, we're putting stuff out there and it's being used to train AI. I don't know if that was obviously not the crux of the writer's strike, but like certainly like graphic artists and things like that are saying, like, we put our stuff on this website, but now it's being used to train AI models. And this is like all very new conversations that are happening. And it's one of the reasons it's kind of exciting, like in the sense that like, we're going to get it figured out. At least I hope we do. And it needs to happen. We need to have these conversations. But in the meantime, it does kind of make me curious as to what YouTube's more detailed kind of plans are for protecting creators, because they have an AI, Gemini, and it used to be Bard. It's gotten a lot better. Like, you know, how much of our content or user generated content is going into like training these, and what does that mean for everything? It's probably going to make a better product, but like, we're also, you can use their AI tools to make AI videos. It's really weird, like tug of war, a really weird ecosystem we find ourselves in.
I think the other thing, Dan, is that YouTube is also battling, or they're trying to come up with ways to make sure that the information that is disseminated on YouTube, it's understood to be coming from trusted sources. And this was a big thing during the COVID time. If any like non-health creator put out COVID information, their channel was automatically, well, not the channel, but the video was automatically like restricted or not pushed to the tablet because they weren't an official source for that information, like the World Health Organization or the United States government, whatever the case may be. So YouTube is also facing that battle, or they're trying to make sure that viewers know that, okay, if information comes from such and such, this is legitimate, true information, and this is going to be a big thing this year with the election coming up. YouTube is also trying to make sure that whatever information that goes out there about the election is coming from trusted sources and not just people trying to maybe manipulate things one way or another. So a lot of that going on.
All right, I've got an editor's correction here. I now have a source from the OxfordEconomics.com that says YouTube's creative ecosystem contributed more than $35 billion, so not 250. But $35 billion to the US economy, so just the US economy. And that was in 2022, so 2 years on from that. And it supported more than 390,000 full-time equivalent jobs. But obviously, I don't think that really equates to the 3 million creators in the YouTube Partner Program, which is kind of a little bit different. But still, creators, human beings earning money from making content on YouTube.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible. So those are the four big bets that Neil Mohan is making for YouTube in 2024. And I think with the current climate and landscape the way it is, I think those are pretty safe bets. And we'll have to see how YouTube moves in the days, weeks, and months ahead. I want to talk to you guys about some YouTube-related things. Now, I saw that last week you guys implemented one of YouTube's newest features. You all did a vertical live stream. So I'm curious to get your thoughts on how that went and how do you think creators will use that moving forward?
You've just done the video, Dan. Take it away.
I did. Yeah, just uploaded a video on this. So vertical live streams are, again, like another really cool opportunity. And one I see creators probably asking us in the coming months, should I be doing this? Should I be doing this? Should I be doing this? And that's why I made a point in the video to say, maybe. Back in the day with shorts, I'm like, you should be making shorts. And, you know, turns out there's a lot of people just hate them. They just don't want to make shorts. They're like, I don't like making content like that. So I'm going to say this. Don't do it if you don't think vertical live streaming is for you. That said, we tried it. We saw some really interesting results. we had double the amount of views on that stream than we would get on a normal Tuesday stream, yet we streamed half the amount of time. The watch time was abysmal, 2 to 3 minutes compared to like 10 to 15 minutes for a long form like live stream we would normally do. So people are coming in and out. And our concurrent viewership was almost the same, which was also weird because we had way more views. So again, people just coming in and out. So it's great for discoverability. I'm sure we introduced ourselves to a lot of people who weren't previously looking for vidIQ, weren't looking for people who were auditing YouTube channels. Maybe they've dropped by other streams. Maybe some of them have dropped by other streams. But I think the people who are going to benefit the most from this, at least how it's currently built, are people who already make shorts and they're looking for another opportunity to connect with their audience, their shorts audience, because these will show up in the shorts feed. So if someone follows you actively and you go live and they happen to be scrolling through shorts, there is no reason why YouTube's algorithm wouldn't go, hey, did you know your favorite creator is live? And you can just click on this button and watch them for a while.
Dan, didn't you say, Dan, as well, that you ran a poll and approximately 50% who watched the live stream were completely new to vidIQ, had never come across us before?
Yeah.
So there's at the moment, a big discoverability opportunity, and there is a first movers advantage as well. But I agree with Dan, there has to be some prerequisites, those being, do you like shorts or do you like live streaming? If the answer is yes to both, then absolutely you should experiment for a couple of streams. If the answer is yes to one of them, then you should probably have an experiment just to see if it's a type of content that you enjoy making. But as always, there are going to be creators who are far more skilled and idea-centric than us who will figure out a way to really take advantage of shorts live streaming. And I'm still kind of expecting this economic shorts revolution whereby people are going to have links on screen and you can literally tap on something to buy it. And you've seen how TikTok really gamifies GIFs and stuff. It is NPC type live streams where they're just making noises and doing actions depending on the GIF that's sent to them. That isn't available yet on YouTube as far as I'm aware. We still just have like super thanks, super chats and super stickies, which isn't quite the same thing. So I think monetarily there's big opportunities as well, but with that caveat of don't just do it because it's a new thing on YouTube, do it with some intent and an end goal to it.
And I would say do vertical live streams for a vertical live viewing audience. There's tips out there on how to do both at the same time. And yes, while it would be great for there to be a toggle so you could watch the live stream in a comfortable format, regardless of you know what device you're on, that would take a lot of engineering to implement that into YouTube. They're never going to do that, in my opinion. So I would say just do vertical live streams for an audience and like make it intentionally for them, just like you would a short. You know, repurposing long form clips is one thing, but re-editing them so a short viewer can get the full context is really important to do. Same with vertical live streams. You should respect that this audience is watching in a certain format, and you know, try not to, I guess, find a shortcut, because I've been testing this and I've tried the shortcut method and it was weird and it didn't work right. And like, okay, these are two separate things for me, I think.
I just want to end as well with this kind of whoa feeling with how YouTube is currently pushing these live streams. Like when you're watching a YouTube video, when you pause a YouTube video, it doesn't give you options to go elsewhere, does it? Just like a regular long form video. You pause a video and then you start the video again. But with shorts, when you pause a short, it is literally giving you this option to say, hey, try live streaming instead. Go here. And I think that's the really interesting question as to whether YouTube's going to keep that button there. Are they going to keep this option so that with the billions of shorts that are played every day and the millions of times people are pressing pause, is that gateway to another part of YouTube going to remain open, or are YouTube going to shut it depending on how it impacts, you know, watch time sessions?
I guess
what YouTube wants to do, sorry, Dan, I'll just finish my point. I guess what YouTube is wanting people to do is maybe spend 3 or 4 minutes watching a shorts. Maybe they figured out the average viewing session for shorts is like 5 minutes. At the end of those 5 minutes, they want to keep them on YouTube with like another 5 to 10 minute session on a live on a vertical live stream.
I think that button probably isn't going anywhere because they just added this for me. Maybe they're rolling it out slowly. There's now a trending button next to the live button. So if you tap that, you get a whole bunch of videos. It's no longer a scrollable feed, but it's like just a bunch of videos. It's just a trending page and showing you sounds that are trending and videos that are trending. Okay. And it's literally right next to the live button now.
Gotcha.
So I think they're just building this out still because they're recognizing, when I see stuff like this, they're recognizing that people don't really leave this feed. And so they're like, well, how do we get people to discover other parts of YouTube if they're never going to leave the scrollable shorts feed? Because TikTok is kind of like that, right? You get on TikTok and you're just instantly greeted by a video and you just keep scrolling forever. So now you pause a video and there's all these options and they're just adding to them. So it's very interesting to see that, like, I don't know. I'm sure it's just a test because it's going to pull people away from the feed, like you said, Rob. Or they're going to, are people going to see the trending tab and go, ah, this is boring, and then close the app? That could certainly happen. So just interesting to see how this is getting built out.
Absolutely. So I kind of want to talk about the age-old debate that we have every now and then on vidIQ. And Dan, you could probably, I think you have the data, so you could probably best inform me, maybe Rob too, you as well. But short versus long. So I think I am in the past, I polled our vidIQ audience, and they seem to prefer long-form content more than short. But obviously, we do short-form content on the channel from time to time. So knowing that we have an audience that prefers long-form content, do you guys see that our shorts are getting the views that our long-form content normally gets, or are the shorts getting less views? Or how do you feel like our audience is responding to the short-form content that we do, given the fact that they prefer long-form video?
In a word, weirdly. I think this is, again, just anecdotal to our channel. A couple of years ago, we made the very conscious decision that we wanted to be a browsed-based channel whereby upon entering YouTube, somebody discovers our content on a homepage and watches it. Brilliant. That was because our search traffic was declining. However, with the shorts that we're making, we get tons of views from our shorts via search traffic. So it's almost like there's been a shift. And it kind of makes sense when you think, if I want an answer to something, I want it as quick as humanly possible, and a short will provide it to me in 60 seconds or less guaranteed. We should probably do more search-based shorts, but we're just always struggling for time. So I think, like, almost going forward for us, we continue down our browse and suggested traffic for long-form content, and we lean more and more into search-based traffic for our shorts. And that, I think, is, again, because of the first mover's advantage as a window of opportunity. Shorts are more searchable these days, and they're just not, you know, the 15 years worth of utility content in that short form style yet. I don't know if that's going to work for other channels, but it's just what we've recognized on our channel. And I see a lot of videos these days saying how shorts ruined my channel. We just haven't experienced that.
Yeah.
If truth be told.
I would love to dig into those claims a bit more. I usually just don't click on them because I inherently don't agree with them, but maybe I should see what they were doing on their shorts, because I feel like it would ruin your channel in the sense that you would get a lot of viewers who aren't interested in what you're doing if you're doing something you wouldn't normally do in the long form side. Like, a great example is, I on my own channel, I started to make some shorts that didn't align with my audience, and I learned this over time because I realized that YouTube was telling me, hey, here's some channels that are similar to yours, and they had nothing to do with what I would do in long form. I made a bad bet with the shorts I was making. So what did I do? I removed them, even though some of them had millions of views, and I moved them to a different channel because I'm like, well, I want to build a certain kind of audience on this channel. And nothing got hurt from doing that. It was fine. It was as if it never happened. and it makes my channel look more focused. It helped me become more focused. So even channels that feel like they've done some damage by doing shorts, it's not too late to, quote, fix it. But yeah, on the vidIQ channel, I've certainly not seen anything negative. It's the negativity comes from, like, do we have time to make a searchable short? Do we have time to make these other things? Like, and that's not even like a negativity thing. It's more like a, oh, shoot, well, we don't this week, so let's not.
Interesting. Yeah, this is all the rage. And I've heard Renee Ritchie, who is the YouTube liaison, say that, listen, if your shorts are targeting the same audience that your long form content normally targets, then you can leave them on the same channel. But if you're trying to target a new audience, or you're trying to experiment with something new, then maybe not put it on your regular channel with the long form content. So ultimately, at the end of the day, it really depends on what your objective is as the creator and what you are trying to accomplish with your YouTube channel. And to Dan's point, we've been doing shorts on our channel for a while now, but the content that we do is similar to what we normally do with the long form. So they kind of been complementary of each other, according to Dan and Rob. But there you go.
Our data says that 20% of viewers are watching both our shorts and our longs. So it's 47% videos only and 33% shorts only. So we still get more people watching our videos. But in the last 28 days, there's been a 20% like crossover, which is interesting.
Yeah, because again, like when I think when I took a poll a while ago about what our viewers preferred, they definitely were on the long form side. So it's interesting to see that crossover happening. But again, our content is normally similar to what we do either or. So it makes sense that there would be some crossover. So
if you think about the shorts feed, if a user spends a lot of time in there, they're not engaging with community posts and polls, for example. So if you were to poll that on YouTube itself, and you see all your audience saying, well, I like long form. Well, they're spending more time outside of the shorts shelf, which is very isolated from everything else. So they're not seeing your community poll. So it's interesting. When you said poll, I think you're probably talking about Twitter or something.
Twitter,
right?
Yeah.
So we could poll this on our YouTube channel. It'd be interesting to see the results because our data shows that 20% of them are watching both and 33% prefer our shorts. But I bet you that poll would be way skewed to the long form side based on how community posts are surfaced.
I think we should do the poll on YouTube. I think we should.
Probably have.
Well, coincidence, I did that today this morning. I ran that poll.
There we go.
Which do you watch most? 88% say YouTube, 12% say shorts. So unless people have like misinterpreted the question and said, oh, well, YouTube is shorts as well, that should answer the question. I've also got another quiz question for you as well. When do you think, this is for all listeners, there's no prizes, but sure, you can tweet us, although you're going to get the answer anyway in about a minute. When was the first video we made about YouTube Shorts? So not a YouTube short, but like when did vidIQ first identify that Shorts was going to be a thing? I want you to both give me a date. Ooh. And whoever wins my love and admiration for the next 10 minutes.
I'm going to say August of 21.
Okay. August 21.
Yeah. I want to say 21 as well. Cause I'm pretty sure I was here when you did that. So I want to think sometime in 2021.
Okay. So looking at the YouTube studio, the first video I made about YouTube Shorts was August the 13th. 2020.
Oh, wow.
So if you can believe it now, short form content has been a thing. And I wasn't the first to notice it. I think people, when they saw that video saying, yeah, I've been seeing this for months. But YouTube Shorts, in some form or another, have been around now for coming up to 4 years, if you can believe that. Mm. That's quite incredible.
I could have sworn it was 21, but I guess that makes sense because I think that's when I was posting the most shorts. I was really excited about it. So I must have learned about it late 2020 and through just our general research and then started posting a lot in early 21.
I'm actually going to check. When did we launch our vidIQ Shorts channel, which is mothballed now? Yeah, September 22nd, 2020, Dan.
Okay.
So we've been around a long time, just not very successfully.
Yeah, I remember back in the early days because there were still a lot of questions around shorts, but creators were still having the advantage of using it and getting discovered because not many people were convinced that shorts would be a thing back in the early days. But now here we are 4 years later and they are everywhere.
I remember when I was tracking the use of the hashtag shorts at the time, and you know it was like a million people used it, then it was up to 12 million. I think now if you type in hashtag shorts, like 700 million references are to that hashtag. And I don't know if that's over a period of time or ever. Yeah, if you hated shorts, unfortunately, your war against them is over. They're here. It's done.
So as we get out of here, I guess I probably already know the answer to the question, but I'll ask both of you anyway. If a creator is starting on YouTube today, which type of content should they focus on? Should they focus on making long-form content or short-form content or whatever?
I think they should try everything. Vertical live streams, shorts, horizontal live streams, regular videos. figure out what they want to do, because there's a lot of different ways you could take a topic you enjoy and get it out into the world. And just know that like every single tool that YouTube has is at your disposal. You can absolutely choose to ignore everything but videos, just regular videos. You could be just a shorts creator. Like, a lot of people will tell you to do all of it because that's like you're min-maxing. You're going to get the best benefit from that. And sure, you might, but like this really comes down to like what we talked about earlier, people's amount of time they have. They have day jobs. They have all kinds of stuff going on. Like, you only have so much time in the day. So if you can dedicate your focus to just one thing, that one thing has a much better chance of growing than if you dilute your time across all sorts of different mediums. So that's my answer to that. I think it's do what works best for you, but start by doing all of it to kind of get a sense of what's working best for what's bringing you the most enjoyment and what works best for your time.
So a lot has changed on YouTube, but my advice on this remains the same, which is to do what you love and find out if after 50 videos or 6 months, you still love making YouTube videos. Nothing beats experience. And I would almost tell... almost suggest, because I have to say almost because I'm kind of putting myself out of work here, is don't bother watching YouTube education channels for the first 2 or 3 months. Just get busy, make videos, make mistakes, find out if this is something that you want to do for the next 5 to 10 years, and then start educating yourself on how to do it more effectively and efficiently. And that might just be advice coming from somebody who's more of a, who learns by doing. There are some people who just want to invest tons of time in studying. And if that's what you want to do, then watch as many YouTube education videos as you need to. But for me, nothing beats experience. Just make content.
Mm. And on that note, I think that's a good place to land a plane. Rob, Dan, appreciate you guys being here. You guys know where to find them. Go check out our YouTube channel on vidIQ, youtube.com/vidIQ. Content going out, what, 2, 3, 4 days a week now? Seems like we have something going on. Seems like there's content every day on the channel, but definitely go check them out and get your YouTube education on if you are inclined to do so. Thank you guys for listening to this episode. You know your boy Viper will be back next week with another episode of Tube Talk presented by VidIQ.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tube Talk, brought to you by VidIQ. Head over to vidIQ.com/tubetalk for today's show notes and previous episodes. Enjoy the rest of your video making day.